How many times have our patients returned to our office and are just stuck in the cycle of chronic inflammation? We throw everything we have at them, nothing changes, and even our dentists are frustrated. Rather than throwing our hands up and shrugging, we need to be turning to PerioTrace by PerioProtect. I have seen the evidence firsthand and have helped so many hygienists find this resource because it really works, which is why there are so many products on the market now trying to imitate them. The results are speaking for themselves, but rather than going with an unproven product, stick with the only periodontal medicine delivery system cleared by the FDA. And not only that, but their support team is seriously among the best I've ever encountered, from the education to implementation to support when there's the inevitable bumps on the road. They are there for you. If you want to get in contact with them to learn more about how you can treat your patients better, head over to perioprotect.com/RDH. And on that site, at the bottom is a contact form that you can fill out or simply email them directly to ask for help. This is one thing I truly believe should be in every dental practice. perioprotect.com/RDH to stop the cycle of chronic inflammation.
If you see that documentary, After the Wave, you see it evidently that the people who didn't find the body, they still have that hope. Maybe they have amnesia. Maybe they're somewhere else. Maybe, you know, and you see the difference between the two. So when we do the identification, it's for the living, because they cannot live a normal life otherwise. It is a very thorny issue. It's very multifactorial, and it affects people on different levels. So you have to protect that individual and the people around you by applying the best method and by giving the best answer for that question. One of the human rights laws for assessing an age of an individual is that the answer has to be in the best interest of that individual.
Get ready for your unofficial dental hygiene podcast. These are the tales of two hygienists, one East Coast RDH and one West Coast Guygenist. Listen as they tackle the profession of dental hygiene with humor and enthusiasm. Now, please join Michelle Strange and Andrew Johnston as they tell you a tale of two hygienists.
Welcome back to another episode of A Tale of Two Hygienists, episode number 197. My name is Andrew.
And this is Michelle. Podcasting extraordinaire.
Podcasting. We'll put that
you
on.
See how I just. Sometime. Yeah, I do want that actually on the back of my shirt.
So we are still in Vegas. We're doing a bunch of these intros kind of right at the beginning. Michelle has been trying to work, and then I start the podcast without her knowing.
Yep.
It's been fun for one of us.
For one of us.
Guess which one that one was?
It's definitely not me.
I have felt like. Sorry to talk about my personal issues here, but my eyes are really dry.
It's face so really dry.
I was so in the shower and I was like, oh, I think my skin is absorbing all of the water that's coming out of the shower head.
Or it burns. Like your skin is so dry when the hot water actually hits you, it burns.
That was when I was touching
you. When you do touch me, my skin sets on fire. I'm scalded.
Oh, I almost got a hug out of you this week.
I don't.
I got like a
No. You might have almost gotten close like because I didn't notice and I didn't run for my life.
After you're like three or four drinks in, and I was like, now's the time. And you're like, nope, still not there. And I was like, well, if it's not after three or four drinks in, it's probably never going to happen. But I'm not going to give up. I'm not going to give up.
Okay. Buddy. I appreciate your.
I am willing to make this friendship work. In all of this. Yeah. I go.
No touching.
No touching.
I'm really enjoying all the fun that we've had. I was actually joking the other night so I went to dinner with Emily Bogey, Kelly Jakes, Claire Zhang, and Joy Void Holmes. Fantastic women, just lovely, wonderful women. And of course, we're all hygienists. And it was probably the first dinner I've ever had with dental people that I didn't talk about dentistry.
Really?
I at the end of it, I was what like, does y'all,
that,
is that?
What is that an experience?
Is this weird that we haven't even talked about dentistry? We just talked about things like kids. Well, their kids, not my kids. Their kids and, you know, selling houses. Some of Emily just moved into her new house. I just moved into mine. Joy was a real estate agent once in her life. Claire did. She was a florist once in her life. Like, it's kind of funny that we all had like lives before dentistry.
I bet it was all like above board, no inappropriate content whatsoever.
Oh God, no, no, no. We definitely, there's not a moment where there's not inappropriate content. Even last night, it was pretty funny.
Oh. I feel bad for the people that were walking behind you.
Can I say the word of the day?
Nope.
Okay.
You cannot. Because we don't want to do that. Podcast. And this is going to be, we need to keep this one a little clean anyways, because
a really good guest.
Episode, Sakhar Alkhitani. You guys have heard him before on the forensics episode way back in Chicago midwinter. Mm-hmm. Today he's going to be talking a lot about like human trafficking and all of the terrible things mm-hmm. that are involved in that arena. I think there's several things that were eye-opening in this.
So eye-opening. And he gave a lot of really good websites to go to. Also, there's an app called Traffic Cam app. So with this app, you'll hear him say that they take pictures of hotel rooms, which we need to probably do right now, and take a picture of the hotel room because it'll upload onto this app. And so if somebody is photographed in while they're being trafficked. Yeah. While they're being trafficked, if they catch like a glimpse of a wallpaper or a curtain design or something, they can match it in this app and find out like where they actually are
to help locate them and save them
exactly
if they need to. Yeah,
which is very, very cool.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of little tidbits, and again, maybe some information I am going to use to throw in people's faces in the future.
Of course you would. That sounds like
I was like, stats, give them to me. But love then it.
There's also the one that when I was re-listening to it, I'm like, oh yeah, when he was talking about how most of like the ringleaders of these trafficking rings are women.
Yeah, that blew my mind too.
Yeah.
Yes. I couldn't believe that when I actually gave that information when I was just in Germany. I was like, did y'all think about this? Like that is, it's actually women.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
Women are terrible. That's what we're learning from all this. Yeah, is that what
woman's going to slap your face today. Just feel it.
I love it.
But one of the things I wrote is like 168 million forced out of their countries every year. So it was about human trafficking, but it was about a lot of things.
Displacement of people.
Just real displacement. Yeah.
Let's not ruin all the whole
exactly.
episode. He does it way better than we do.
He was amazing. And I could talk to him for hours every day.
Yeah.
Just every day.
But I mean, sincere thank you to him we were in Australia at the time. He's living in Brisbane, I think temporarily. Mm-hmm. And he took the time out of his day to meet with us and hang out with us and show us around a little bit.
He took us to the most amazing breakfast where I've had the most amazing banana bread I've had in my life.
It was seriously really good.
Yeah.
Like I think about that meal sometimes.
It's so good.
Good conversation was had. Mm-hmm. Like it was just a good, good time.
It was. So
thank you to him. And I hope you guys really enjoy this episode.
Hey, Michelle.
Yeah.
It's time for the interview.
Oh, but I had something else to say.
We need to let the experts talk now.
Fine.
Okay, I'm Sakhar Alkhitani. I'm a forensic dentist and a pediatric dentist. I work in King Saud University in Saudi Arabia. I'm an honorary professor in the University of Queensland in Australia, where we are now. So welcome to Brisbane.
Thank you.
Sunny Brisbane. Hope you like it. And I lecture around the world on age estimation and human rights because I developed a method of age estimation. And so I go around testing it and lecturing about it with an emphasis on human rights.
So one of the hygienists that I just did a panel interview at RDH Under One Roof, she works with special needs and people with pretty severe disabilities, and so they can't tolerate x-rays.
Yeah.
So they actually end up doing these intraoral pictures as identifiers, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah. I mean, we not just that, but we also use the pictures from social media.
Mm. Oh.
Because now more and more people don't have any problems with their teeth, so they don't have a dental record us to use. But everyone has a picture. Mm-hmm. On Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, whatever. So now with the newer generations, we have more and more people being identified using their teeth, mm-hmm. using their pictures. We use like superimpositions of the teeth on the body, mm-hmm. because sometimes you don't have the features anymore. They decay, they're decomposed. Mm-hmm. And then you just have the teeth, and then you compare it to the picture.
Mm. That's hard.
And digital scanners as well.
Yeah.
This is a more, and then you can print them out as a 3D model, and then you have a set of teeth, and then you can compare it with their mouth guard or bleaching tray, even if you don't have the body. But if you have that digital scan, then you can print it out, and then you, if you have a mouth guard, which they did in an airplane crash in Spain.
Wow, really?
You remember that airplane crash when the pilot committed suicide?
No.
With the airplane full of school children.
What?
That never made it to my news feed, apparently.
What?
Yeah.
What kind of human?
He locked himself. I mean, like he was the co-pilot. The pilot went to the restroom. Mm-hmm. So the co-pilot locked himself up and committed suicide. And there was a school trip. So all of them were, you know, school, high school children. And one of them didn't have any dental records, anything, no remains even.
Mm. Oh,
but God. The mother had a sports guard, you know, for sports, that was done in school, even not in the dental office, but she had it. Mm-hmm. And then they poured it out, and then they did the identification based on the model.
Because they had teeth?
They had the teeth, but nothing else.
So they could have matched the occlusal molar fit. Oh my gosh. Mm. Oh, he committed suicide. Jesus.
And that's why they changed the airplane laws now. So no one can stay alone in the cockpit.
I've noticed that. The flight attendants, one of them will go in there and while the pilot comes out, use the restroom or whatever.
I've never noticed. I'm going to ask Brock about this.
And then they, they'll put that little thing in front. And so there will be a couple of flight attendants like up there. And so the pilot and flight attendant and pilot and flight attendant.
I'm going to pay more attention. Normally I'm just too busy working on a flight, I guess.
That was a long time ago. I think it was 3 years ago, 4 years ago, something like that. It was a flight from Spain to Germany, I think. And he committed suicide in the Alps and in the French region.
No.
Just like crashed it.
I mean, that just makes me want to... what are they doing for mental health and the pilots that are, you know, how are they checking them and making sure that nothing like that?
He had red flags on him.
He did?
Yeah. From a psychological point of view, I think he was depressed and things like that. And he said, the black box, when you hear all the children screaming and the people knocking on his door. And he said that I'm going to change history or something. Well, which he did, because they changed the laws regarding the security.
Yeah.
Right.
But I mean, the cost of so many lives.
I feel like that is a thing that happens a lot, where we retrospectively see all the red flags. Like, oh yeah, they had a psyche vow that was not quite favorable.
Yeah.
But no one did anything about it.
Mm.
And I think Julia Worrell would chime into this, that a lot of flight pilots met our flight attendants have some pretty severe sleep issues, which then go into the state of depression. So it's like, if you make sure that people are sleeping properly, that they're not with their circadian rhythms aren't as jacked up, and maybe you would have less chance of depression. And God, that's so awful. Awful. How do you deal with that?
What?
That aspect, like if you're doing the forensics and identification of all of these horrific things.
I'll tell you one of the stories that affected me mostly. There was here in Australia, there was this girl that got swallowed up by a crocodile. I mean, like there was an Aborigines family went to this lake. And they were like a big family. And the uncle went into the water with nine nieces and nephews, and then they saw this big wave coming, and they were like, "Okay, it's a crocodile, everyone out, head count, one missing." And then so they called the police, and here the crocodiles are sacred to the Aborigines, so they had to do a ceremony first before they killed the crocodile.
Oh wow.
So the elder of that tribe, who was the father of the missing girl, she was a 9-year-old girl. Anyway, so he did the ceremony, and then he pointed to one corner of the lake. He's like, it's there. And they went there, and it was there. And they killed him. And I think he was isolated in this lake for a long time, was very hungry. So he swallowed the girl whole. So she looked like she was sleeping, you know? So, and this is, When they're in that state, it's more difficult for me because they still fresh and they look fresh. Whereas when it decomposed, I don't see the human anymore. Yeah. I just focus on the work. And it got to me a little bit. So I asked my friend, when does your heart become dead and you don't feel these emotions? Because sometimes it's difficult. And he told me his story, which I carry with me. He said that he's a very recognized forensic dentist here in Australia. He was recognized. He was given the honors from the Queen, like the highest honor, like a knighted something. One of his first cases was a skeleton remains of a teenage girl that was found. She's been missing for 12 years. And so they identified her, and the police told him, we cannot deal with the mother. She's crazy. You tell her. So he didn't know what to do. I mean, like what to expect even. So he went to this mother and he told her, we found the skeleton. It's your daughter. So she hugged him and she told him, thank you for telling me she's dead. Mm-hmm. For 12 years, she's been, hoping, thinking the worst. And hope is a devastating force because she wouldn't say, oh, she's living somewhere happy with someone she loves. I mean, like she's always... Is she locked up in a dungeon? Is she being raped or tortured or whatever? Right. This is the thing. And every time she hears that the police found the body, she calls the police and then she, curses the hell out of them because she wants her daughter back. So that's why they said, well, she's crazy. We cannot deal with her because she's aggressive, and rightfully so.
Yeah.
And when he gave her that closure, he said to me, every time I see a difficult case, I remember the feeling I gave that mother. That closure is what you work for. You see beyond this. This is dead already. Doesn't matter. He has a human right. The body has a human right to be identified, of course, but they're dead already.
Yeah.
You do it for the living, for the relatives, for the loved ones. There was a documentary called After the Wave here in Australia done on the relatives of people who were affected by the tsunami 2004. The Southeast Asia,
Did that affect Australia?
The documentary, Australian documentary, done on the relatives of people who either found the bodies of their missed loved ones or people who didn't find the bodies. Mm-hmm. So they're still missing. And the documentary was done 11 years after the tsunami. So 11 years later. And you see the difference between these two people. There is the people who found the bodies, they got closure. They moved on. They grieved. They got closure. They moved on. The ones who didn't find the bodies, they're still in that state of mind. They couldn't move on. The wound is still open. And this is in psychology, it's a syndrome now. It's called Srebrenica syndrome because Srebrenica is a village in Bosnia. And in the early 90s, there was a war between Serbia and Bosnia. It was a very vicious, dirty war. And in this one village, the Serbs, it was like Christian Muslims. So the Serbs went to this village called Srebrenica, and they collected 18,000 males, and they disappeared. And the females of that village, they didn't know what happened to those loved ones, the father, the son, the brother. And they developed the syndrome of not knowing, of being in limbo. What happened to them? Are they still alive? Are they dead? Where are they? Where are their bodies? And the Serbs killed them all, killed all these 18,000, put them in mass graves, which are now being dug up. And since the mid-90s, that was the biggest human identification mission, which is still going on since the mid-90s. And they didn't just kill them, they burnt the dental records as well. So they're doing it by DNA now. I mean, every day they have this huge cemetery there and they add everybody that they identify. But that syndrome, this syndrome called the Srebrenica syndrome because it affected this whole society of women. And now you can see it. And if you see that documentary, After the Wave, you see it evidently that the people who didn't find the body, they still have that hope. Maybe they have amnesia. Maybe they're somewhere else. Maybe, and you see the difference between the two. So when we do the identification, it's for the living because they cannot live a normal life otherwise.
That was an interesting perspective.
Yeah. This is heavy.
That is heavy. That's that is a heavy way to start this thing.
But fascinating at the same time. Just a part of life that you just don't think about unless you're in it or gone through it.
So this is, though, one aspect of what you do. I think we wanted to really try and focus on more of the human rights for the living in this particular episode. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So where do we start with?
Yeah. How would you like to guide this?
Yeah.
Well, okay. So now forensic odontology, to begin with, has three main branches. Okay. Human identification, age estimation, and bite mark analysis, along with the clinical mishaps or maltreatment.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Okay. So now in these years, I would say since the mid-90s, I mean like 2005 onwards, we're living in the worst human crisis in recorded history in regard to wars and the people that have to flee their homes. The statistics say now we have 168 million people forced out of their countries. So these people become illegal to be on Earth, basically. Mm-hmm. And if you put that number in perspective, it is 33,000 a day that are forced out because of various things. And then there's nowhere else to go because no one is taking them. Out of this number, 22 million are registered refugees, which is different because you become a refugee if you are recognized as a refugee. You're given a piece of paper. Until you have that piece of paper, you're illegal to be on Earth. You're between borders. And then 10 million are stateless. So they don't have a state even to go back to. Out of all these numbers, the people who were resettled, this is the latest statistics by the UN, was in 2016. Out of this 165 million, only 189,000 have been resettled. And this is not portrayed in the media. So these millions of people have to find safety. Mm-hmm. And some of them don't have identification papers, so they need to have an identity. Some of them are younger than 18, and anyone younger than 18 should be granted asylum because they're, according to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which was the most ratified convention in history, 193 states, the UN states have signed it, ratified it and signed it, except the USA, Somalia and South Sudan.
Interesting company we keep.
Yeah. I think it has something to do with, it is a law that has to go through Congress, something like that. There's because it's a law. So you have something.
An extra step or something.
So I'm not sure why they haven't signed it yet. Anyway, so any country that signed that convention has to provide asylum to anybody younger than 18. Mm. Safety, education, health, you know, all these things. So lots of people claim to be younger than 18 to get asylum. Mm-hmm. And countries want to make sure that they are younger than 18 to give them asylum because it's resources to give to other people. So it's from both ends. They need to make sure from a human rights perspective for both parties, for that individual to prove that he's younger than 18, therefore deserves an asylum, and for the country to make sure that this person deserves that resource that I have. Mm-hmm. So it's a very hot topic, this age estimation thing. And this is for people coming in requesting asylum. But we have this other set of people who are living within a society under the radar. So they're illegal. They don't have any papers. And then they get involved in a crime, for instance. And then you need to take them to trial. How do you try them as an adult, as a minor? Even as a minor younger than 18, you have different ages that has different repercussions on the trial.
Right.
So did you reach the age of criminal responsibility or not, which is different from state to state in America, which is different from country to country as well. Some of them are young as 7 years old as age of criminal responsibility. Some of them are as high as 21. So it differs from one country to another. So we need to make sure where in the spectrum is that person is to take them to trial. And not just that, also for sexual consent. Is it a rape or not? Is it because consent has nothing to do with it if the age is younger than the consent age.
Right.
Like now the Jeffrey Epstein in the news, he claims that the girls that he
had relations with
claimed that they were consensual, but they're younger than 18. And consent has nothing to do with it. It could be considered as human trafficking, even if they consented for that, because they're younger than the age of consent. So age estimation is a very hot topic. And identification as well, because they need to have a birth certificate to start work, to go to school, to get married. And many countries, I mean, like the rate of birth registration varies from one country to country. 50% of births are unregistered in developing countries, and 30% in developed countries are not registered.
30%?
30%. This is by the WHO.
So, wait, so then that means they wouldn't have the documentation to prove what they need to be able to prove. Okay.
They don't have a birth certificate. So, like they're living, they're citizens.
Yeah.
But they just don't subscribe to the norms of society. They don't get registered for one reason or another.
Is this like maybe like at home births as opposed to going to the hospital?
Yeah. One form of it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Like in Saudi Arabia, for instance, when I heard the statistics, I was you know, shocked, because like how in this day and age?
Right.
And then when I went there, I was starting working in this age estimation clinic. And there was 80 a day of children of come in. They get to the age of school and then they need the birth certificate. So the citizens, but they had birth, like home births. They didn't bother with the registration. And then age of school comes and then they need the birth certificate. So they come to the age estimation clinic to get that certificate. And in the UK, there was this community of people, they call them the travelers, who live in caravans and they move from one place to another. And then they don't subscribe to the norms.
Mm.
You find this in all over the world.
Mm.
This communities that they either illegal or they're nomads. And this rate of birth registration can get as low as 3% only of registered births in Somalia. Or like in sub-Saharan Africa, it's very, very low rates of birth certification, registration. And when you see them, there's a map by the UN regarding this difference in rate of registration, and you see the colors. So the red colors are low registration. And you see that most countries that where the refugees or the asylum seekers come from are from those countries with a very, very low birth registrations to begin with. So they might not even have the documents. They might falsify the documents later. They might lost it. And sometimes the falsification of age is done on a state level. The Chinese gymnastic team that won the gold medals, they were falsified their ages because they were older than they should be to enter the competition. And they were found later, and then the gold medals were taken from them. In some countries, they falsify the ages so that they can marry their daughters where they're younger than the legal age of marriage, for instance, or to put their children into work early, or child soldiers as well. So they falsify the documents. And then at one point comes a situation where this age is disputed, and then you have to give an accurate estimation of that age. And teeth are one of the best parameters in the human body to give that age estimation, because it's very robust. That's not affected by environmental factors. So we can count on it. And it doesn't it's not different between different races, like bones development is, for instance. So teeth are very important in these aspects for the living.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say,
How often, though, as we're using teeth as kind of the guidelines, is there, like, what's the percentage of error that is acceptable? Because I just saw a kid who, I think he was 15 and he already had his third molars erupted in the mouth, which would be, by our standards, very early. So what's the variance there?
Well, when we talk about teeth and age estimation, we have to be careful regarding two things: eruption versus development, which is two different things.
Okay.
So developing teeth can erupt at any stage of development. Eruption is not linked to the rates of development. It's like if the tooth is in a certain stage, doesn't mean that it will erupt at that certain stage. It can erupt either earlier or later. So eruption is affected by environmental factors, affected by nutrition and things like that, but not developmental stages. So if you take an X-ray, then you can see the internal structures of the teeth and the developmental stages,
like the pulp canal.
Yeah, the opening of the apex. Yeah, and that is the robust bit of the development. But at the same time, we have to remember that human development goes under a normal distribution curve. So you have early developers and late developers. And what we do is that we assess the teeth. We give an age estimation, and it's an estimation. So there's a plus minus error rate depending on the age of that child. Look, for instance, the younger the person is, the more accurate the age estimation is, because you have so many teeth developing. And at later ages, when you only depend on the third molar, I think we're in the middle of phasing it out and an evolution process. We're phasing it out from humanity. So you have this 30% of people don't have them to begin with. It's missing. And the rest, it's all over the place. So it's a very, very variable tooth. And you have to, when you do age estimation, you give that error rate, plus or minus, you say 2 years or 3 years. So the younger ages are more accurate within 6 months of the actual age of that person, which is acceptable by the law, depending on the method you use. But the third molars are more variable, with plus minus 2 years. So in that case, depending on the question from the court, is it, do you want age estimation to get a birth certificate? Or do you want to know if that person is a minor or a major? Is he over 18, younger than 18? This is a different question, has a different answer, by giving a probability of that person being over the age of 18, which is more, I think, in my opinion, the best way to answer that question. Is he a minor or a major? You give that probability. Mm-hmm. If you want a birth certificate, you want a document, you give an age estimation.
Mm. Okay.
If it makes sense.
Maybe your person was inaccurate with their age.
I didn't see his birth certificate, so you're right.
Could have been 18.
Just kidding.
No, but it can get from like
the development's
14
different.
To 22. This is very variable, the third molar. And when you do it for that purpose, for an asylum seeker, which has a huge human right implication on that individual, because it is a variable tooth.
Mm-hmm.
And if you tell the court, no, he's not. And some countries don't use teeth. They use social interview, like a psychological assessment of that person. And they
how does that work with men?
Because we're always babies, is that what you're saying? Yeah. We're always infants.
I don't think we reach that maturity at all. So there was one case in the UK where they assessed him to be a minor and they put him in a foster family. And then they took him to a dentist for something. And then the dentist said, well, he's not a minor.
Yeah.
And he wasn't a minor. Uh-huh. And he was put with children in a foster family. And that is you see the danger of that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or the other way around. Yeah. Of assessing a minor to be an adult. And you put them into detention with adults.
Yeah.
You know, violating their human rights. So it is a very thorny issue. It's very multifactorial. And it affects people on different levels. So you have to protect that individual and the people around them by applying the best method and by giving the best answer for that question, which is not known all over the place. The court sometimes doesn't know how to ask the question. And the dentist or the forensic dentist or the team who does the age assessment, because sometimes it's bones, sometimes it's psychological, sometimes it's social or dental. Sometimes they don't have the full facts of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this age being disputed? Because one of the human rights laws for assessing an age of an individual is that the answer has to be in the best interest of that individual, whether it is older or younger. This is one of the pillars of doing an age assessment. It has to be because you have this error range, right? You have a plus minus. So he can be anywhere plus minus this age range. Mm-hmm. So the threshold can be in the middle of that age range. So he could be, or she could be, in either side of that threshold and could be correct because you're still within that age range. So you have to understand
what the case
story, yeah, which is not always given to the person doing the age assessment, which is in violation of human rights, actually. This is by the European, there was a European Council for Age Assessment for Refugees, and they have this set of rules mm-hmm. that are being violated, actually, by so many countries. And not just that, sometimes that answer that we give is not subjected to, if the person doesn't agree, he cannot appeal.
Hmm.
So if someone's called a major,
then he cannot appeal.
He cannot appeal yeah. that. And he really was on that cusp yeah. of being.
Yeah.
And now his future is
ruined.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is a big problem.
Yeah.
And another problem is that sometimes these people are detained on the borders for years. Oh. And sometimes they lose that window of being a minor and deserving,
so
asylum.
It's not going to be based on when they came over and were detained.
No.
It's at time of trial or analysis.
Yep.
Wow.
Unless they took x-rays the first time this doesn't happen usually.
And that this is hardly doesn't seem fair either.
I'll tell you what's not fair as well. You as taxpayers pay 20 times more for a person to be detained on the borders than if you let them in and give them money as from social services within the society until their papers are processed. This is Amnesty International.
I would love that stat. Like, give me a link to that because I will post.
I have it. It's like by Amnesty International.
I would love that. Not that I'm the type of person that likes to throw things in people's faces.
Right. That never happens.
Never, ever.
Every single time on the podcast.
I mean, evidence that makes me right. I don't like. Yeah. You're an iPhone. You can just share that with me.
I will.
Just airdrop that on over because I think that's fascinating. So is that other countries too? Just the US?
No.
No?
So everywhere.
Everywhere.
It's everywhere.
It costs more to detain them.
It costs more to detain them. And sometimes it can cost up to $1 million a year. Or as I think the lowest is $400,000 a year to detain a person.
What does that cost?
Wait, one person?
One person.
One person a year.
And is that food and water and healthcare?
Water, law. Yeah, healthcare.
But we're also assuming that they aren't probably feeding them and giving them proper care. And still that's costing, because I'm thinking they're doing subpar everything.
Like, well, yeah.
People aren't eating.
And I'm thinking too, it's like it's government bids. They're contracted out to detain the people. And that's all of what's happening. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It baffles me if that information were put right in front of Americans' faces. And then mm-hmm. we decided to maybe vote on changing legislation or whatever, that would be like, yeah, of course we don't want to save money. And yes, we want to have productive citizens.
This is one of the problems of the media plays a huge part in scaremongering people.
Yeah.
And saying that they're coming to take our jobs. They're coming to, the terrorists or whatever the reason is or whatever the story is or the angle they want it. But it's never on reporting that these people are forced out of their countries. They don't have a choice mm-hmm. to begin with. This is their last I mean, they die on the way over, whatever it's over is, whether it's Europe, whether it's Australia, whether it's like the Middle East or America, they die on the way because there's no other way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know that in Europe, 8 out of 10 minors that reach Europe, like these refugees, asylum seekers, are unaccompanied.
Mm.
So they're human trafficked, or like people smuggled, I would say, from Afghanistan, for instance, or Iraq or Syria, or whatever, to UK, for instance, alone, unaccompanied.
Is that because they are paying money to have someone escort them to there, or that because they're actually being like kidnapped and then transported over?
No, we have two different issues. The human trafficking issue, which the person is being coerced into something and then forced to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And human smuggling, where someone pays for a contractor to transport them internationally from one place to another, but they have no other obligations.
Once they get there,
They're free. And so the families back in the troubled areas, maybe they don't have enough money for everyone, but they have money for this one child.
Save their child.
And they have that choice. So they give them the money and then they are trafficked throughout whatever it is. And the amount of people who are minors and non-accompanied is on the increase everywhere, which is a huge problem. And I think history will judge us very harshly in the future, because this crisis that we live in has never been, has never existed in recorded history with this amount of numbers, even during World War II. This is worse than what happened in World War II. But we don't think of it this way. And sometimes when I give lectures regarding the human rights and the age estimation and the minors and the refugees, usually I do it around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to study the history of that country that I'm going to give that lecture in.
Mm-hmm.
And all the time, they've been through that at one point of history. They've been refugees at one point of history.
Mm-hmm.
They've been stateless. They've been forced out. They've been, you know, affected by famine, war, whatever. But we forget. And sometimes it's not, I have these pictures that I can share with you. Maybe you can put it on, I don't know, on your website or something, with the same line of people, one going from right to left and the other from left to right. And it's Greek refugees going to Egypt and the other way around, from Egypt to Greece, or like from German to Syria and Syria to German. Like within the span of 60 years.
Oh, wow.
It's these two nations that were in exactly the opposite position.
Mm-hmm.
But we forget. And I think empathy is taught. You teach your child not to take that toy from his friend. You take it away and you say, no, you have to share. And you teach them empathy. And I think we forget to teach each other empathy. And we forget that our nations were there at some point of time. We were all, I mean, movement of humans were the norm. This construct of borders and this harsh laws regarding people's movement is a new concept. And it wasn't there before. And now by having that, you create this problem of people being illegal to be on Earth. Because where would they go?
Mm-hmm.
Pre-World War II, there was this more freedom of movement when there is something, they mean like they went somewhere else and they were accepted and they were, you know, taken into other countries easily. And you can work and you can be productive and you can pay taxes and you can be, you know, a productive citizen in that new country. But now the laws are getting harsher and harsher, understandably, of course. But at the same time, there is this human price that we pay and we don't know that we're paying it. With lives, with lost lives, with lost futures, with lost. There was here in Australia, there is this amazing orthopedic surgeon who fled Iraq during the war. He was his family, you know, paid, I mean, for him to be, you know, smuggled into Australia. And then he was detained here on the border and he stayed 3-4 years in the camp. They have camps on the border in an island. And his paper got lost and he got lost. And then one reporter heard about him and then you know, brought his case to the public, their processes gave him asylum at the end. Mm. And now he invented this, orthopedic for like lost limbs, which is implanted in the bone. So it's part of your body. Oh. And he was this amazing brain, an amazing surgeon. It stuck there. And how many like him are we losing? Not all of them are brilliant, of course. Not all of them are educated, of course. But we have some great minds that may be lost within the system because we do not have the resources. We don't want to give the resources, although we have the resources. But because we're scaremongering people and there is this fear of losing your identity as a citizen of this country. So you have this high nationalism going on, understandably, of course, but at the same time, diversity always enriches a society, always enriches it.
Preach.
Why do you feel, or what have you learned about the motivation behind the scaremongering is it money? Is money always the root of having borders, having these harsh laws, having these restrictions kind of across the board? Like what's the impetus for a nation to do that, or us as a generation to be doing that?
I don't think it's money, because as I said, as taxpayers, you pay more to keep them out than if you get them in to begin with. I think it's the fear of the other.
Hmm.
Everyone's fearful of the other. Of the other language, of the other religion, of the other culture. I think it's just that. And a little bit of racism involved. Regardless of the race, you're always afraid of the other.
Mm-hmm.
But when it suits you, when it's beneficial to you, then you human traffic them. And then you force them into labor or sex trade. Human trafficking, let's go back to human trafficking, generates $150 billion a year.
Holy Jesus.
And it's not just for sex, it's forced labor as well. And the most affected people are from East Asia regarding the labor, whereas sex is more like Russia and, East Europe. But it's everywhere around the world. And when I say human trafficking, I don't just mean taking them from one country to another. It can happen within someone's country. They can be in forced labor. They can be forced marriage, for instance, is a human trafficking act. Mm. And if that bride was forced to have a physical relation with that husband, this is sexual human trafficking. And if she was forced to do housework, and this is a case of forced labor. But we don't see that. These numbers don't even go into statistics. And the statistics I think we have 120 million people into human trafficked. So this is modern day slavery. And if you, the cost of having a modern human slave is $90. Whereas in the 1800s in America, the cost of having a slave was $40,000 by current money. So Whoa. It's cheaper now to have a slave. And that's why it is happening. And not just for forced labor or sex, but also for organ harvesting, for surrogacy, and for taking the fertile eggs from women.
So it's real on Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah.
Happening.
Blessed be their fruit. Yeah, it's happening.
I'm glad that you caught her little reference. I never catch any of her references.
Never gets any movie, TV references. Yeah. I appreciate you very much right now. Thank you.
She's looking for a new co-host.
And the fact that you gave it back to me makes me heart you a lot. Always give references. You never get to
And it. People see that. The Handmaid's Tale is a very good example, actually. People see it as a drama and it's not happening. But it happened in ISIS. It's exactly the same story that happened in ISIS overnight. Syria at one point was a very free country. Mm-hmm. It was they have a dictator, is the beside the question. But I mean, as a society, women were free to dress whatever they want. It was a free society, Western society. And all of a sudden, ISIS came and women were being sold in the streets. And if they said no, they would be killed and hanged. It's exactly like Handmaid's Tale in our modern times. In this day of social media, it can happen and it happens. Sometimes we don't know about them. We don't hear about them because it's not in my, near society. But it happens somewhere else in the world now.
But so how do, if it's not happening in my part of the world and I'm not seeing it, then how do I get involved and how do I understand that it's actually happening?
Oh, that's a very good question. I think relying on your national media, regardless of what national is, based on whatever country you are, think you have to broaden your horizon a little bit. I think you have to work. As I said, empathy is taught. So you have to teach your children to have empathy towards other people and reach out. I mean, a lot of times when I travel, I see the same type of news, I mean, like the same incident from different angles in different countries, depending on that the agenda of that country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you see it from different angles and all of them are correct, but it's highlighted from their point of view rather than the other. So I think having a rounded vision of the world is very important.
Yeah.
And being involved in organizations like the UN, the refugees, they have New Amnesty International. It's a good source of having these numbers, having these, you can donate, you can volunteer. And I think it's important for you as, podcasters to send the message out that you have to reach out, you have to make the effort because lots of people, millions of people are suffering and we don't know about them. And, we have a responsibility to those people, as privileged people as we are.
100%.
Do you feel that the amount of traveling you've done in your lifetime has kind of shaped your view of these incidences?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, I was born and raised in Saudi Arabia. And I only knew Saudi Arabia at that time. So, I know what I know. This is, and you fear the other. Mm-hmm. This is the norm, I think, everywhere.
What was, just sorry to digress, but what was the other for you at that point?
Any other.
Any light-skinned anyone?
Any different. The color of the skin wasn't in the equation, but it's the other culturally, the other religiously. Mm. I don't know them. I don't know what they, do they mean harm to me? Do they want to change me or shape me into their image, or am I going to lose my identity? How do I protect my identity? How do I defend my beliefs and system? You know, all of these. So it was when I first went out to the UK to study, there was this struggle because I was on the defense, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, like I want to protect my identity.
Sure.
I don't want to be lost in this new culture. And there was this me and them, and there was this internal struggle. They didn't care about me. no one would. I mean, like to change you. No one wants to change you.
Right.
This is only, it's like you project internally on your own belief system. But then with time, you see when you focus, I think the point is if we focus on the similarities between us, we have so much in common rather than the differences, which is less than 5% between religions, between cultures. Humans are humans. I have one workshop that I give about age estimation, and I gave it 35 times in the past couple of years in different countries, in 19 countries. And I gave it to students, so I have students all over the world. And, we were talking earlier regarding the audience. And the amount of similarities between them, regardless of language or religion or culture, and some of them are in remote areas, some of them are in very developed areas, and we have so much in common. And if we focus on the similarities, if we see someone new in your neighborhood, in your coffee shop, in your local pub, anywhere, someone new, go and ask them questions. Where are you from? Like, learn from each other. Diversity is so enriching on the personal level, but also on a society's level. you get more out of it. Even statistically, more successful people come from diverse societies. They did like the statistics with like villages and towns and cities where it's like more homogeneous and where people are diverse. And diversity always shines.
I believe it.
Yeah. And this is the school system, this is the media, and this is on the personal level. And I think change happens from within. So you start with yourself and then you start with the people around you. And I would say, stand up when you see prejudice.
Yes.
Stand up and say so, either like the on social media or whatever. Make it either stop with you, don't retweet, don't engage. Or stand up for the weak, stand up for the, you know, for the hate preachers,
yeah.
I would call them, regardless of what they are. Even if you hate people on Love Island. Do you have Love Island in USA?
What is it?
The program, Love Island.
Do we not?
I don't think so, no.
Do they go to an island and just like try and...
Find love.
Yeah. We have that. We have a show. Like, I'm surprised you don't know all about it.
If it's not on Bravo, I don't really know.
No, but my point is sometimes people go on these programs, reality TV shows, and then people started to hate them. They don't know them, but they start, you know, hate messages on social media to those people without knowing them personally. You just see that facade on the TV and then you just make a judgment and then you go with it. And this is a very small, you know, aspect of this hate, but it translates into other religions, translates to other skin color, translates to other cultures. So it starts from a very simple seed, but it can be a really, really big issue within someone's heart and mind.
Which is totally unfair also because it's the network's
portrayal
of that person.
Uh-huh.
They're only giving...
They edited it to make it
to make
like
the storyline of what they want. So even that's not even a real thing that the person is starting to hate against.
And you would think it like in this age that we've had reality TV for so long that we would all be very aware that we are told a story. It's reality TV, air quotes, but it's a story given to us.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. Like it's, you then create this blanketed idea that all people that look like this will behave like this when that wasn't even a true perception or portrayal of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about human trafficking and the rate that we as dental professionals might see someone and if we, how we can identify if they are.
Well, I think we can do a lot. I think those things. First of all, there's a nice app called Traffic Cam. Have you heard about it?
No, I'm not.
Traffic Cam, which is, you download it. I recommend you download it. And then what? Whenever you go to a hotel, you take pictures of your room.
Oh, that's right. You did tell me about that on the last one, because I've been thinking about that a lot lately. Go ahead and continue the story.
So you take pictures.
Can you, as much as I travel, you can tell me about this?
I wasn't paying attention, but it's a great, I mean, it's a great idea.
It's, yeah. So the idea of it is that you take pictures of your hotel room and you upload it on this app. And they have this huge database of walls of hotels. Because when people are human trafficked, especially sexually, they take pictures of them.
And you can identify.
And that they can identify the surrounding. So you help them being found.
And download that immediately.
And this is another interesting thing regarding human traffickers themselves. This is one of the evil professions that are not dominated by men.
What?
Yeah. I think the study was found that maybe half human traffickers are females. Most of them were human trafficked themselves.
I was going to say, is it because that's all they know?
That's all they know. And yeah. And
hurt people hurt. That same concept.
Yeah.
Hurt people hurt.
And not just that, because they don't have any skills as well. They've been human trafficked into sex and then they put in these situations for a long time.
Yeah.
And then they're left with no set of skills, no language, no nothing.
But they know the business trafficking. And
they know it's lucrative.
Yeah.
They can get up to $35,000 a week. Pimps.
Pimps, players, and hustlers. Welcome to the 1994. Oh, never mind.
These are the things that you know?
Yeah, I was on Warren G's.
You don't get, I'm right on top LP. Of that rose. But you get that?
Pimps, players, and hustlers.
Oh, oh. Gosh.
Back in the 90s, that was the cool saying. So yes, I do absolutely know that.
So my question, and something that I've always been wanting to get into, is helping those that come out of human trafficking or sex trafficking, and from a dental perspective. And what do you know what their needs are if they are, you know, found and removed from that setting, what they might need? Because I'm assuming they're not getting dental visits. I'm assuming they're not getting like actual
health
care.
Service,
yeah. Is there something that we can do as dental providers, or even help identify?
I think our role would be in the identification process, not just as healthcare providers, but also in society. Because sometimes you see the signs, and most of the time when we see the signs of abuse, usually it's abuse. So it's, you're talking about psychological abuse and physical abuse. And people, when they see that, it hurts so much to see that, to recognize it, that you look away. And this is one of the major things that we need to change in our minds, that if you see something, a flag, you have to report it, because you never know who you might help. But humans tend to look the other way when it's uncomfortable. And that is done a lot. Sometimes you see the flags all over the road. As we were talking about that airplane with the pilot who committed suicide, he was flagged before for psychological problems. But we look away. When it's uncomfortable, we look away. So be wary of the signs of physical and psychological abuse, because you can see them in the streets, you can see them in school, you can see them definitely in your clinic. But I wouldn't think that they would bring a sex worker.
You don't think they would?
I don't think they would, because they usually, I mean, the statistics say some of them maybe would, but I mean, like, even if they came, she would be escorted by someone. So there is a sign. You see someone in charge or in control, and then you can either try to separate them, take x-rays or anything, and then ask the question, do you need help? Or just give them a number, you know, of helpline or something discreetly.
Who told us about the, for sex traffickers or anyone who is in domestic abuse, when they do separate them like that, they have a brochure, but it's in the shape of a shoe, so they can stuff it down into their shoe.
Was it India? Chance?
Was it India?
She might have been telling us about that.
So the brochure, so they're not like walking out with their goodie bag and toothbrush and like, oh yeah, here's a sex abuse brochure. But they can, as a hotline in some way to get help, they can put it down into the sole of their shoe and like put their shoe back on and walk out with it without it being noticed by their person, captor or somebody.
Yeah.
Which I thought was brilliant.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant idea.
So smart. So to kind of loop it back around to the dental side and the age analysis and bite marks, how do people get into this? Like, because we actually see a lot of burnout in our profession, and maybe wanting to change up some things, maybe have a little bit more of a meaning in their profession, not just scale. How could somebody get involved in either this research or doing the age analysis, bite mark analysis?
Well, dental hygienists and dental auxiliary are a huge resource that is not known to a lot of people. I mean, my friend Amber Riley is one great example of a dental hygienist who works in forensic odontology. She gives lectures around the world. Mm-hmm. And recently she gave a lecture in Interpol in the disaster victim identification meeting to all disaster victim identification people, which is forensic dentists, forensic pathologists, DNA people, fingerprints, and the police. And she said, her presentation was, as a hygienist, what can I bring to the table? And the answer was, she can bring a lot to the table as a dental auxiliary, because if you have a set of skills that maybe is not fully in a dentist. Mm-hmm. So you have a different set of skills that you can utilize. So I would say attending workshops, and attending sometimes seminars regarding forensic odontology. Mm-hmm. But there are really good workshops that happening directed to dental auxiliary or healthcare providers that can be involved in forensic odontology for sure. And not just having that work on your day-to-day basis, but you be prepared for when you're needed. Because sometimes if a disaster happens in your area, you can help.
Okay.
You can contribute.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have that training and your background, you have that knowledge, then it's easier for you to volunteer and you can help because the numbers are low in general for forensic odontologists around the world. The numbers are very low.
Because of need or just because of
there's
lack of demand?
Or? There's no, it's not lucrative. It's not lucrative. So usually people have it as a second or like a subspecialty.
I gotcha.
But if you have that set of skills, sometimes you'll be needed. There'll be like a huge hurricane or a big tsunami or earthquake or volcano, any disaster. And they usually require a lot of people to help with the identification process or whatever they're working on. So when that happens, you'll be ready to give your services. And it's a very different topic, interesting topic. So I recommend that if anyone is a little bit interested to attend at least one lecture or one workshop and see how they feel about it.
Where can they go to find like those lectures and workshops? Because you might not see it posted with your local component.
In the United States of America, there's the AAFS, the American Academy of Forensic Sciences meeting, which is in February. You can visit the ASFO, American Society of Forensic Odontology. They have a list of events that goes on throughout the year. In the UK, they can check the British Association of Forensic Odontologists, BAFO. And they have a list of seminars and workshops in the UK and Europe. In Australia, you can visit the Australian Society of Forensic Odontology or Australian and New Zealand Society of Forensic Odontology. And they would have information on that as well. That happens, around the world. So it's not as frequent as general dental meetings. But when they do meetings, it's usually one concentrated one and you get a lot of experts from around the world usually in one place.
Did you say Canada's? What Canada? We have a lot of...
Canada. Usually the AFS covers Canada. Canada, they have a nice full program in Montreal. It's a master's program. But in the U.S., you have lots of workshops and diplomas and smaller nice. Scale. Can do over a weekend.
If anyone wanted to find out where you're going to be lecturing and speaking, how would they reach out to you?
Twitter, probably the easiest. My name, Sakhar Al-Qahtani. If you Google the London Atlas of Tooth Development, you'll see my method of age estimation. And you can see my name there because it's difficult to spell.
And we'll have it in the show notes too, so they can just find it and link into that.
I'll give it to you. Yeah.
Awesome.
So Twitter would be the easiest.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I'm sure a lot of you, your heads are just spinning. And if you're like me, you might have to even listen to this podcast twice.
This is one that you're going to want to share.
Yeah.
Share with all of your friends. Mm-hmm. I think that there's so many vulnerable populations out there that could really utilize this information.
You know, there's been a few. I think all of ours are definitely all re-listenable. Like you should go and like get more tidbits. But like the suicide prevention one, child abuse, and then this one are just, they're heavy subjects. But gosh, they're so important and the conversation needs to be had. And it just, the more we know, right?
Well, I think that also kind of humanizes us. I think sometimes we get pigeonholed into this idea of, my name is Andrew. I am in this box of hygienist. And that is like, I can only do the clinical work of a dental hygienist and only think about that kind of stuff. But when you start to listen to these types of interviews, then you're like, oh yeah, before I was a hygienist, I was a human being. And now we have to like network and work with each other and see our patients, not as patients, but as people and as like, you know, humans.
Well, and I think also we get stuck in a bubble and we forget that there's something, let's say, out of South Carolina, out of the Southeast, out of the East Coast, mm-hmm. and like taking it just bigger and bigger and bigger and reminding ourselves that there are a lot of people that are really struggling.
Yeah.
Really struggling.
Yeah.
You think you have it bad and then.
Yeah.
You hear these stories, but we also want to thank PDT for providing CE content or CE credit, I guess, for this CE content that you got today. And please check them out. They have amazing instruments, but they're also just amazing people, an amazing company. Linda Miller is a female that runs this global company and just really cares about the people in her under her wing. So we appreciate them and you should ask your reps about them. And if you want to learn more about the PDT Gleason guide that I'm obsessed with for sharpening, you should definitely contact me and CE Zoom for providing the credit. And if you have multiple licenses, you should check them out for sure.
Good job on that word.
Yeah. Licenses.
Cool. Yeah. Okay.
Licenses.
If you haven't checked out the Dental Podcast Network, Channel 1 and Channel 2, now is a good time to go over there. Make sure you subscribe. Make sure you tell a friend. Make sure you share all of the posts on social media.
Mm-hmm.
You can follow us on Instagram.
There you go. You can do it.
Facebook. I'm sure there are ways to find us on that, those things. I don't know.
The gram. Yeah, definitely like us, follow us, check us out on iTunes, review all of those things. We definitely appreciate those. And subscribe to our newsletter if you haven't already and checked out our website that's brand new where you can actually search on our website all of the podcast episodes because we are well over 200 and there's tons of content. We would just love, love, love if you guys shared this information. This podcast is fueled by you guys learning. And so we want to spread that. So let everybody know that they can check out free content on multiple podcast channels.
And then if you are attending AOSH and you happen to be listening to this, Michelle is there with you. Go find her. She's there this week. And yep. Also next week, I will be in New York. So after the course that's held by Tony Stefanu and Teresa Duncan, Beyond the Operatory, I think Saturday night, if you guys are available, I think we're going to try and meet up and go to a thing out in Queens that like a public marketplace, something mm-hmm. like that. So if that sounds interesting, you guys want to meet up with a few of us, then that'd be kind of fun to do as well. We will also be at Greater New York. Michelle has some other travel. So just let us know if you guys are in the area. We'd love to meet up with you guys.
Yep, that'd be great. Anything else?
I think that is it. I hope everyone has a great week.
Bye, y'all.